You are listening to a podcast from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
I'm director of the Program on International Policy Attitudes and the project worldpublicopinion.org, which is a collaborative project of research centers around the world that the Program on International Policy Attitudes at the University of Maryland manages. The study that we're going to present today is part of a larger study that we're doing looking at different aspects of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which is having its 60th anniversary this year. And we have already released some studies related to gender equality, racial discrimination, and freedom of the press. Within the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, there is the statement that the will of the people should be the basis for the authority of government, and that that the will of the people should be expressed through elections. So this is one of the central themes that we want to explore in this study. The study itself included interviews with 17,525 respondents from around the world in 19 different countries. And you can see the list of these countries here. The margin of error varies depending upon the size of the sample, but it's generally in the 3-4% range. In the majority of cases, the survey was done face-to-face, but in the developed countries and some others, it was done by telephone. In a few cases, it was a primarily urban sample. For the rest, it was a nationwide sample. In the United States, it was done. The questions themselves were asked over the internet, but it was done with a company called Knowledge Networks, and they recruit their sample over the telephone, so it's a true a random sample and truly representative. And if people don't have internet access, they're given internet access, and then the questions can be administered over the internet. It's not the same as these opt-in internet samples. Now, one of the things that we're going to be exploring as we move through this is the question of how people have different attitudes depending upon how developed their democracy is. And so, unlike in the report, which is ordered by regions, we've decided to order the presentation of the findings in terms of the ratings that the countries have received by the Economist Intelligence Unit, which has established what we thought is a pretty good criterion for democracy ratings. And these include whether and how much, to what extent they have a competitive multi-party electoral system, whether they have universal adult suffrage, whether they have regularly contested elections, and whether there's access of parties to the electorate through the media. And here is how the countries that we're going to be looking at fall out on that rating system. At the top, we have the full democracies, the U.S., Great Britain, and France. One step down, the term flawed democracies. I didn't make up that term. I know it's a little strange. And within that category, we have South Korea, India, Poland, Ukraine, Mexico, Argentina, Indonesia, and the Palestinian territories. One step down, then, is what they call hybrid regimes, which are Turkey and Russia, and then at the lowest level, authoritarian regimes, Jordan, Egypt, Nigeria, Azerbaijan, China, and Iran. So we have a good array here of countries at different levels of democratic development according to the EIU ratings. Now, starting first with the attitudes about democratic principles, what we find is rather extensive, widespread support for democracy in principle. Let's just start with elections. As a general rule, do you think government leaders should be selected through elections in which all citizens can vote, or do you think they should be selected some other way? And here you have a clear majority in every country endorsing elections as the means for selecting leaders. On average, 84% endorse elections. India is, you'll find that India throughout, it has a kind of peculiar pattern. I don't have a good explanation for it. They're supportive, but they have a larger number of people who take a contrary position on a lot of issues. And in this case, it's 33% saying that they should be selected some other way. But other than India, you have, it's 7 in 10 or higher in every country. Now, we took this statement straight out of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, that the will of the people should be the basis of the authority of government, and asked whether they agreed or disagreed with it. And as you can see, overwhelming majorities, except in India, agree with it. Overall, on average, 85% agree with this principle. 52% say that they strongly agree. The averaging, by the way, is just an average. We didn't weight. When you actually do weight, it's surprisingly how little effect it has. But it's debatable whether it's a good idea to weight or not. But in any case, these are averages across countries without weighting. And as you can see, there's really, for both of these questions, you can see that there really is no correlation with the EIU ratings. Remember, these are still organized and will be throughout according to the EIU ratings. And for neither of these questions is there any relationship between how developed they are as democracies and how much they support the principles of democracy. We also asked, how much do you think this country should be governed according to the will of the people? And we gave them a scale of 0 to 10, with 0 meaning not at all and 10 meaning a great deal. And again, right up and down the line, every one of them was well above 5, and the average was 8. And again, there was no relationship between support and the country's EUI democracy rating. At the same time, relatively few gave the answer of 10. You know, it's not that they're saying that the will of the people should have absolute control. On average, only 31% gave the answer of 10. But there was in the Ukraine, 52% gave it an average of 10, and in Indonesia, 51%, and in Russia, 49%. Interestingly. I'm also going to share just a few slides from the work we did on press freedom, because obviously that's quite related to the question of democracy. And we asked, how important is it for the media to be free to publish news and ideas without government control? And again, the support is quite robust. The numbers you see here are just the numbers that say it's important. And on average, 82% say it's important, 53% very important. And again, that's right up and down the line. It's only India hanging back there, but still a majority. In India, just because you see 52% doesn't mean that it's 48% on the other side. A large number either say don't know or it depends. They are somewhat more resistant to taking positions on as presented. Do you think the media should have the right to publish news and ideas without government control, or that the government should have the right to prevent the media from publishing things that it thinks will be politically destabilizing? Well, here you get a more mixed picture, and there does seem to be some relationship between democratic ratings and the attitudes. In the most democratic countries, U.S., Great Britain, and France, you get very large majorities, 7 in 10 saying the media should have the right to publish without any control. And then as you get down into the mid-levels and lower levels, it's more mixed. In a few countries, you do have majorities saying the government has the right to prevent publishing things that could be politically destabilizing. Indonesia, the Palestinian territories, Jordan, Egypt, and so on. And there is some relationship here between the EIU ratings and this belief that the government has the right to prevent things from being published that could be destabilizing. Now, that is in principle. When you ask people, what do you want to see in your country relative to what is occurring now, it's actually quite a different picture. Ask, do you think that in this country the media should have more freedom, less freedom, or the same amount of freedom? Well, curiously, the most developed democracies here, there at the top, have some of the lowest numbers calling for more freedom. Well, that's arguably because they're more satisfied. Well, if you look down there at the bottom, at the countries that are the most authoritarian, that have the greatest restraints on media, you have clear majorities in almost every case saying that they want more freedom. So just accepting the principle that the government should have some control doesn't mean that they actually are necessarily happy with the level of control that they have. And it's worth noting here that in Jordan, Egypt, Nigeria, Azerbaijan, and China, these clear majorities call for greater freedom. Iran, less so. Okay, now, we want to turn to this very important question about trust in government. And we're looking at the relationship here between trust in government and democracy. And this is one of the more sobering findings of the study, and I should mention it's not the first time that it has been found. There's been other research that has found this pattern as well. Ask, how much of the time do you think you can trust the national government in the capital to do what is right and offer just about always, most of the time, or only some of the time, with never accepted as a volunteer? You find a rather uninspiring picture here about confidence in government. And you find that there is actually an inverse relationship between these democratic ratings and the trust in government to do the right thing. Doing this mathematically, there is a rather robust a negative correlation between trust and democracy at the 0.658 level, which is quite strong. Iran didn't specifically answer this question. They wanted to modify the wording a little. Basically, though, they give themselves a pretty good they have a fairly high level of trust. 48% said they trusted the government a lot, 26% some, and only 14% rarely or never. It was not only some. So it's a pretty good rating. Now, what's going on here? Why is there this negative correlation? And that's going to be kind of central question that I'm going to be trying to answer going forward now. Now, first, a number of thoughts might come to mind. One possibility is that people in authoritarian countries are not telling the truth, that in fact they're concerned that they might get in trouble if they say something critical about the government. Now, we can't determine for sure whether that's true or not true, but there are a number of important things to point out. First of all, quite a few people do express critical responses. As you can see, in Nigeria, 57% are somewhat critical. In Azerbaijan, 56%. And you'll see that in other questions that we ask as well. So there is some significant criticism. Also, it is worth noting that there have been no reported cases of someone getting in trouble with the government for an answer that they gave in a survey. Still, it's possible that there is some effect here, and we do need to keep that in mind. But on the face of it, does not appear to be an entirely satisfactory explanation because so many people are still critical. Another possibility is that the people are misled into having falsely positive views by the government-controlled media. And, of course, there is some relationship between these levels and the of democracy and government control. But here again, you have a complexity. Some countries with government-controlled media have publics that are quite critical, and some with government-controlled medias are not. So that doesn't, it's not a complete explanation, even though it might offer some insight. So what then is the variable that can help us explain why people are so widely supportive of democracy, but people in so many highly rated democracies are so unhappy with their government, and why people in with low levels of democracy have more mixed views, let's say. So there are two questions here. Why are the more developed ones unhappy? Why are the less developed ones mixed? Well, the key hypothesis we're going to look at is that the objective features of democracy, the kinds of things that the EUI ratings look at, such as elections and suffrage and so on, access to media, that those are not enough to engender trust or satisfaction in government. And the hypothesis that we were looking at is that there are what we're calling subjective features of democracy as opposed to objective that are critical in creating satisfaction. One of those is democratic responsiveness, that the perception that the government is responding to the will of the people and that outcomes are in line with what the will of the people wants. We asked, how much is this country governed according to the will of the people? And on a zero, and then to answer on a 0 to 10 scale. This again is a rather sobering set of numbers. On average, the response is 4.5. And if you look at the top there, the developed democracies, they're in the U.S. it's 4.0, Great Britain 4.9, France 4.6. But as you go down to the bottom, you start seeing the numbers rise. And in China, it's 6.7. Jordan 5.4, Iran 5.9, and these numbers do are negatively correlated at the 0.331 level. We also looked at the relation. Remember earlier we asked how much influence should the will of the people have on a 10-point scale, and then we asked how much should it have. And then we looked at how many people gave a higher score for what it should be as compared to what it is. And this is the number. First, on average, you have 4.5, what it should be on average. Well, on average, it should be 8.0. Sorry, it should be 8.0. It is 4.5 on average. And then looking at the percentage that said gave a number that was higher for what it should be than what it is, you see these percentages on average. 74% said that it should be more than it is. And in nearly every country, you find this majority, including in authoritarian countries. And in this one, there was not, these were not actually correlated with the EIU ratings. Though there are some exceptions, Jordan was particularly low on this question. And China and Iran were below average in the percentages calling for more responsiveness. Now, we then took the whole sample and looked at the relationship between the level of trust in government and the perception of government responsiveness. Among those who perceived that the government is responsive, who gave a score of 6 to 10 in perceived responsiveness, trust was quite high, 65%. Among those who said that the government was not responsive, they gave a 0 to 4 response in assessing the government's responsiveness, the trust was only 31%. In Iran, we found the same pattern. Those who gave a score of 6 to 10, they said they trusted the government most of the time. 70% of the time, those who gave a 0 to 4 response was just 14%. Very big variation. We also looked at the gap, the number. Like if you had a 4 and an 8, the gap was 4. There's a strong relationship between how much you perceive the gap between what is and what should be in regard to the will of the people and trust. If there was no gap, trust was 63%. If the gap was 1 to 3, it was 53%. 4 to 6, 37%. 7 to 10, 24%. So the bigger the gap, the trust just begins to fade away. The gap between what people think, how much the government should be responsive versus how much it is. Now, another hypothesis that we are exploring that's another dimension of this subjective aspect of democracy is the question of whether government leaders are actively paying attention to public opinion on an ongoing basis, trying to discern the will of the people. And we asked a question borrowed from the ideas of Edmund Burke presented to positions. Do you think that elections are the only time when the views of the people should have influence, or that also between elections leaders should consider the views of the people as they make decisions? Edmund Burke being the British philosopher and legislator who made the case that the influence of the public should be limited to occasional elections. Well, this Burkean argument did not do very well. Large majorities right down the line said that, not right down the line, there were two exceptions, said that between elections, leaders should pay attention to the people. In India, and it was divided. In Turkey, you had a peculiar majority saying that the view should only be during the elections, though it's a little confusing because on other questions they said that the people should have even more influence. Palestinian territories were also divided. But overall, this was the dominant view, a rejection of the Burkean argument. This Burkean view is related to trust in government. If you are a Burkean, right? If you think people should not should have limited influence and policymakers should not pay attention except during elections, you express more trust in government. 56% of Burkeans show high trust. But if you think leaders should pay attention between elections, you tend to have low trust, 57%, which obviously goes along with the perception that it's not happening. We also asked about paying attention to polls. As you know, in this country, candidates will sometimes brag that they don't pay attention to polls. And we asked, when government leaders are thinking about an important decision, do you think they should pay attention to public opinion polls because this will help them get a sense of the public's views, or they should not pay attention to public opinion polls because this will distract them from deciding what they think is right? This was, if anything, kind of weighted to the second position because it gave a reason that could distract them. Nonetheless, this just went down in flames. Majorities in every country said that policymakers should pay attention to polls. On average, 80% endorsed paid attention to polls. And here again, this was correlated with trust. If you think that leaders should not pay attention to polls, those people show more trust. If you think they should be paying attention to polls, a majority show low levels of trust. Now, one other subjective dimension. The question of whether policymakers should be actively trying to serve the collective good as a kind of conscious process, or if we should assume that in the kind of marketplace of competing interests, we'll have outcomes that are good or in line with the will of the people, that a kind of laissez-faire model. And I don't think our questions are perfect for fully testing this debate, but we have some that are helpful. This is actually a question that has been asked for some years by World Values Survey. And we asked, generally speaking, would you say that this country is run by a few big interests looking out for themselves, competitive interests, or that it is run but for the benefit of all the people? Now, you get, this is again a rather sobering picture. In most countries, majorities say that the government is run by a few big interests looking out for themselves, competing interests. Though in some, you find majorities saying that it is run for the benefit of all the people. What are those countries? Well, they're all down there at the bottom. Jordan, divided, Egypt, 57%, and China, 65%. But not all. Nigeria and Azerbaijan perceive it as run by a few big interests. Also in Russia, by the way. So on average, 63% perceive the governments are run by these competing interests, not trying to do what's good for the people. And this correlates negatively, the perception that it's run by a few big interests correlates positively with democratic development. That in democracies, people are less apt to believe that the government is trying to do what's good for the people. And this correlation is quite robust. And if we look at the relationship between trust and this perception of the government is run by competing big interests or for the benefit of all the people, those who perceive that it is run by competing big interests have low levels of trust, while those who believe that it's run for the benefit of all the people, you have very high levels of trust. So there's a very strong correlation. Now, I want to make one other little sideways before we come back to the main conclusions, because we were also wanting to look at whether people thought the democratic principles should play a role in international relations. So we asked, how much do you think the government should take into account world public opinion? Should democratic principles play some role in international relations? And the response was rather robust. On the 0 to 10 scale, the average response was 7.1. That's only a little bit less than the 8.0 that they thought the government should pay attention to their own people at an 8.0 level, and the government should pay attention to other publics around the world at a 7.1 level, including in the U.S., where the mean response was 6.6, though that was at the lower end of the spectrum. Then we said, how much do you, in developing its foreign policy, how much do you think the government does take into account world public opinion? And the mean response was 5.1. The U.S. was the lowest at 3.9. And then looking at how many favored the government taking more account of world public opinion than it actually does, you find majorities in most countries, but not all, 65% in the U.S., and on average 57%. And you also find majorities in Egypt, Nigeria, slight majority in Azerbaijan, and half in China. Now, coming back to the main conclusions, support for democratic principles is remarkably universal. If you just think of, I think that's a really a profound finding, even though it's not the first time it's been found. There really is a global consensus that democracy is the way that people want to be governed. At the same time, trust in government is low in advanced democracies and mixed in authoritarian countries. So thus it appears that the objective features of democracy are not enough to engender trust in government. That the publics are looking for what I'm calling the subjective dimensions, which are responsiveness to the will of the people on the part of the government, ongoing attention to public opinion, and the government being run by a conscious effort to serve the collective good, not competing interests. And these subjective features are not positively correlated with the objective features of democracy. In fact, they're actually negatively correlated. So in promoting democracy, this requires furthering the subjective dimensions of democracy as well as the objective dimensions. The people in authoritarian countries may be wary of the chaos of competing interests unless they have confidence that leaders are actually trying to attend to the will of the people and align themselves with it. The people in developed democracies are not satisfied with the kind of market outcomes of competing interests. They both are looking for a government that is attentive to and responsive to the will of the people and consciously seeking to serve the collective interest. Okay, I'm going to now turn it over to... let's take a few questions sort of on the poll itself, but kind of the broader questions about democracy. Let's postpone until after we get the comments. But first, let me just take a few questions very specific to the poll. Please wait for the microphone and state your name.
Raghubir Goel from India Globe in Asia Today. It's a great educational report that you have given. My quick question is that what is different between democracy and human rights and the freedom of the press? And second, as far as this poll is concerned, where did you go to poll the people, in urban or in...
Yeah, I'm sorry, where?
Where did you poll the people? Where? I mean, in big cities or... as far as India is concerned, where did you go in India?
Right.
And another thing is that since India is called to be the world's largest democracy, but why all these flaws are there?
Yeah. I'm going to postpone the big question about democracy and freedom of the press for the later discussion. Where we polled. In India, it was primarily urban, but not entirely urban. It was predominantly urban, but through a process of random selection. Most of the polls were nationwide polls, random samples, probability samples. But when they were urban, of course, they were randomly selected within those urban areas. Why is India so different? I don't have a simple answer to that question. I would be kind of curious to hear what you think. I'm looking forward to sort of digging deeper into the Indian data. We have done focus groups there, and there is a kind of complexity in Indian responses, but they are not entirely satisfied. Even though they embrace democracy in principle, they are clearly not entirely satisfied with the outcomes. But it's also not entirely clear what they might want as an alternative. They don't seem to be drawn to some kind of authoritarian model. But they're expressing dissatisfaction in complex ways that we have not entirely been able to put together to see exactly what it is they're unhappy about. Another one up here.
Mike Miyazawa, you've been conducting opinion polls around the world very actively, and I guess it costs you a lot of money. So I've got a couple of weird questions. A, how much did it cost you, for example, to conduct this 19-country opinion polls? And B, how do you finance your overall expenses in general?
Well, see, I got a credit card here that goes really a long way. The model of worldpublicopinion.org, this collaborative project, is that there are research centers around the world that do study public opinion, and so we're working together, and in each country they're responsible for covering the costs in their country. That's not how it always works out, though. There are some countries where we have to pay the full cost, some where we pay part of the cost, so it's kind of a mixed bag. But it's highly variable depending upon what arrangement we work out. As for the sources of support, well, there are a number of foundations that have given us support for these projects. Particularly the Oak Foundation. Back there.
I'm Viviana Jagaman with Freedom House. What was the criteria chosen to select the countries?
We cast a wide net, recruiting partners from around the world. And so to some extent it was a function of where we were able to find partners. But we aspired to get partners from every region. And then in cases where we were underrepresented, then we went out and actually hired some firms. So we tried to get a comprehensive picture. We also particularly went after the large countries, and the countries that we have here represent 59% of the world population.
Hi, I'm Michael Signer at Center for American Progress. I understand that you have a universal pursuit of democratic principles among the peoples, but did you consider that one variable for the inverse correlation might be that the fact that a country is authoritarian is in some sense an artifact of public opinion, or that there are differential peoples in different countries pursue constitutional governments differently, and that you might have authoritarian governments and the people might be responsible for it somewhat in one country versus another, that you have
some
flow.
You mean the people actually like authoritarian governments?
Right, or that there's some, there's a lot of anthropological speculation about that among...
I would put that is that people don't just ask, are we living in a free system? They ask, is the government doing what is in line with the will of the people? And if they are doing what is in line with the will of the people, they are probably more forgiving. If they perceive that what they're doing is in line with the will of the people, they're more forgiving, even though they embrace all the principles of liberal democracy, the free press and elections and so on. If you go down the list. And so, and then I did focus groups in China, and the theme there in China is we aspire to the full panoply of democratic principles, and we are moving there. We're making adequate progress, but we also perceive that our government has not gone off and is doing something completely different from what we want. They're doing a pretty good job, right? So if a government is perceived as successful and you have high growth rates and things like that, then people are more willing to tolerate shortfalls in terms of the democratic principles, even as they endorse them. And interestingly, and the Chinese government endorses it too. They say we are evolving toward more democracy, that this is a natural developmental process. And so in that sense, people get comfortable, as long as they sense this movement. One more, and then we'll...
It's Mike Schneider from the Maxwell School. Steve, were the studies able to get into the demographics, party affiliation, mm-hmm. age, gender, income?
Not so much party affiliation because there's not a common system around the world. Let's see. Evan, do you want to comment on that? Evan is our
in the report, so where they're mentioned is in the report is where they were, at least in terms of income and education. For the most part, there was no correlation when it came to urban versus rural or gender. there were a couple of notable exceptions, and I'd be willing to talk to anybody afterwards about those notable exceptions. But in aggregate, there wasn't any real differences when it came to gender. Interestingly, India was one of those places where there were some interesting differences demographically, and I'd be willing to talk to people about that. But the ones that were mentioned in the report, and where they were evident, there was variations between the countries.
Okay, now I'm going to we'll have some a few minutes at the end for some more questions. But first, I want to turn to our commentators. And first of all, we'll hear from Thomas Carruthers, who's the vice president of here at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. And he oversees the Democracy and Rule of Law Project, which he founded. And he's a leading authority on democracy promotion and democratization.
Thank you. I think I'll just stay seated. Thank you very much. I'm going to give some fairly general comments about the state of democracy in the world and the relationship of the information here to that, and then Tom Mealy is going to go somewhat more specifically into some specific points about the questions and the information presented. I thought it would be useful to talk a little bit about the state of democracy because I think a survey like this is of interest when you're concerned about the state of democracy in the world. And it's been, I've noticed in the last 3 to 5 years here in Washington, there's been an increasing number of events and an increasing amount of talk and thinking about the idea that, in fact, democracy is in trouble in the world in a certain sense, and this has not been a good decade for democracy. And I thought it would be useful to think about this in that relationship. Now, I would start by saying that those of you who are familiar with the think tank world, which many of you are, know that you have to be a bit suspicious in Washington of trend-mongering, in that people in think tanks wake up in the morning and hope that there's some exciting new trend going on in the world because otherwise life is boring. And therefore, in my experience, people tend to seize too much on small sort of kinds of directions and call it a major trend in the world, and suddenly the United States is one day the indispensable nation, and then 3 days later the United States is basically on the decline and is now irrelevant in the world and so forth. And that's true with analyses of the state of democracy as well. And so I'm going to try to talk about that a little bit. In addition, the subject of the state of democracy has been very much politicized in this decade because this administration has so much committed itself, rhetorically at least, to the promotion of democracy, and because it's been an administration both in the way that it does that and what it associates democracy promotion with, and also its just general approach to international affairs is very controversial. Assessments of the state of democracy end up getting linked to people's feelings about the administration. And so, therefore, people who are very optimistic about the state of democracy in the world are often so because they feel that must be true given certain actions that have been taken, and those who are pessimistic feel that must be true because they don't like what the administration has done in one place or another. So we have to free ourselves a bit both from trend-mongering and also from the politicization of the subject and try to step back a bit and with as cold-eyed or clear-eyed perspective as possible to ask, is democracy really in trouble? I think the evidence is mixed, and what I'd like to do is tell you when I try to do a small balance sheet, what comes out on the negative side, what comes out on the positive side, and what are the likely causes of events on both sides of the ledger. On the negative side, these are the kinds of things that I think people point to. First, of course, is the stagnation in the number of democracies, the fact that according to Freedom House scores over the last 10 years, there has not been a net rise in the number of democracies in the world. So the third wave of democracy seems to have stagnated. And when you look around the world region by region, you can accumulate a fair amount of troubling information. So if you look at the former Soviet Union, clearly the backward slide in Russian politics over the last 10 years is a very troubling development, and it takes with it, or certainly solidifies, equally bad political developments in Central Asia and the Caucasus. So if you're looking for bad news, you can start in the former Soviet Union. You can then turn to South Asia, where obviously in Bangladesh in the last couple of years there's been some disturbing backward motion. Nepal you can take as negative if you wish and can get worried about the election of the Maoists there. Thailand has gone through some democratic interruption and so forth. Turning to South America, some people point to what they like to call the rise of populism in Ecuador and Venezuela and Bolivia and see this as potentially threatening to democratic consolidation in South America. Then in the Arab world, you can point to the fact that 5 years ago, at least it looked to some that there was a bit of impetus towards political reform or even democratic reform in many parts of the Arab world. And today, 5 years later, which is, I think, a very short vantage point, but still it's a relevant one, there's a feeling of blockage in many Arab countries, and it's hard to point to much of that having carried very far. Africa is quite a mixed picture, but there's enough troubling news coming out of Africa that one can certainly point, whether it's the ethnic disruptions in Kenya, the consolidation of authoritarianism in Ethiopia, the suffering that's gone on in Congo, and so forth. And then there's populism in Central Europe and the disturbing fact that in this decade you've seen countries which were thought to be very well consolidated, like Hungary, experiencing disturbing levels of political polarization and even political violence, not to mention the sort of disturbing government that Poland enjoyed for a few years during this decade, some trouble in Slovakia and elsewhere. So the first is the sort of the accumulation of lots of small to medium, in some cases such as Russia, large amounts of bad news in different parts of the world. The second is what my colleague Bob Kagan, who's presenting his book here tomorrow, his book's called The End of Dreams and the Return of History, he talks about, and many others as well, the sense of a rise of the alternative, of the authoritarian alternative, particularly in the form of the Chinese government and the Russian government, holding out both to their own people and also to neighboring countries in the world more generally, the idea that strong hand rule is really the most effective, particularly when combined with a sort of a good focus on economic growth and successful economic performance, that for the first time, some people argue, in at least a generation, Western liberal democracy is facing a kind of ideological challenger. And so it's not just that bad news is accumulating in lots of places, there's actually an ideological challenger, and it's taking the form of authoritarian capitalism, or as at least one writer in Foreign Affairs called it. In fact, if you look obviously at the system of government in China and Russia, they're extremely different from each other, and to say that that's a unified political model, I think, is painting with too broad of a brush, but it's an attractive idea and one that has taken hold in some quarters. And associated to that is also the idea that there's kind of a forming sort of informal league of non-democracies. So when people see pictures in the paper of the president of Iran together with the president of Venezuela, and they just got back from a resort in Belarus or someplace like that, you begin to think, what's going on there in the world? There's some sort of new alliance forming of these non-democrats, and this is related to the rise of authoritarianism or the resurgent authoritarianism in other places, and it begins to feel like it's more than just an alternative in a few places, but something of a movement. And then third, there's a sense of trouble with the democratic standing of the United States due to actions in the war on terrorism through which the United States has besmirched its reputation as a symbol of human rights and democracy in the world. I think quite a few people in the world lament the damage that has been done to America's reputation, and they add this to the negative picture as well. So these are the major things that I think are coming together in people's minds and making people feel that democracy is in trouble. When one says, well, what's the good news on the other side of the ledger, you have to scratch a little bit harder. But I think if you take the decade of a whole, you have to go back and point to the EU accession process, which, although it's probably been completed for the time being, did successfully in this decade integrate a number of countries into the European Union on a democratic basis and really help consolidate democracy in quite an extensive region of Europe, and that's quite a historical change, actually. Secondly, in Latin America, you can also turn the argument a bit on its head and say that really what's surprising about Latin America in this decade is how well democracy has survived despite the pressures coming from sort of citizen movements that want greater inclusion and so forth, that actually democracy is in surprisingly good shape in Latin America given the pressures on it. The same argument can be made in Africa, that there are at least, say, 12 to 15 countries in Africa that are doing surprisingly well on democracy despite the pressures there. One can go to Pakistan and say, look, even though Pakistan was beaten down by authoritarianism for a number of years, what's remarkable is institutions have survived in Pakistan and citizens are pushing back against a military government. Same could be argued in Thailand and possibly even in Nepal and so forth. And, of course, in the former Soviet Union, although the color revolutions turned out to be far from a fourth wave of democracy, still there have been positive developments in this decade in Ukraine and in Georgia, fragile though they are. So the positive side of the ledger is less impressive, but still it's important not to just, I say, to give in to doom and gloom. Now, what about the causes? What if there is, to some extent, an accumulation of bad news? Why is this occurring? And here, again, I think people find an eclectic set of reasons that it's not really clear that they relate to each other, but they're all important. The first, and this relates to, I think, some of the findings of the survey, is in the third wave of democracy, many weak democratic states are having a lot of trouble performing for their citizens. and citizens are biting back, and to some extent the rise of authoritarianism in Russia. In this decade is a reaction to the disappointment over the democratic experiment of the 1990s. The same is true in Venezuela. The same is true in Bolivia and a number of other places where there are non-democratic forces pushing against the existing structures. Second is, of course, the rise in price of oil and gas. And it's hard to really underestimate the importance and the power of this. If I don't have a handy chart of all the countries that have seen greatly increased revenue flows from natural gas and oil in this decade, but if we saw the list, it's a club of non-democracies, and many of the regimes are quite nasty ones. And the transfer of resources in this decade and the decade to come to these governments is astonishing when you look at the numbers. We're talking, you know, well over $1 trillion in the near term going to these governments, and that has, you know, tremendous significance both for where the money is going from and where it's going to. This has consolidated a number of shaky autocratic regimes, given them ready cash to play political games in their own countries or in their own regions, such as in South America with Venezuela, with Iran, and with Russia, and so forth. And third, of course, it makes Western countries much less likely to push on these governments because they're in need of steady energy supplies and so forth. So the rise in oil and price, the rise in the price of oil and gas is really probably the most serious structural cause pushing against democracy at the current moment. You can extend that and go into commodity prices and say we seem to be entering a period in international economics in which commodity prices are going to stay high for a long time. And this is not just about oil and gas, but it's also about copper and tin and platinum, and as well as wheat and soy and corn and so forth. And this is clearly going to have some interesting effects on the political economy of a number of countries in different parts of the world. So in South America, it's been useful in this decade to help, for example, keep Argentina afloat at a time when it was really facing serious problems at the start of the decade. But the longer-term political economy effect of high commodity prices is not really clear, in that it's stopping the emphasis on service economy development in a number of developing economies as they realize they can survive and, in fact, thrive with primary products. And therefore, it changes investment decisions by government policy. It changes concentrations of wealth, changes the nature of labor forces, and so forth. And we're just starting to get our arms around what will be the consequences of sustained high commodity prices on the political economy of political liberalization in many countries. Another factor, structural factor, if you will, is, in a sense, the fragmentation of sort of social communities that seems to be a result of the rise of the Internet and Internet communication in societies. We see it, of course, here in the United States, where there's a strong sense that the greater the level of Internet communication within the society, the greater the kind of social polarization that occurs, fragmentation into sub-communities, lack of common conversation, and so forth. This is turning out to be a counterweight to the expected pro-democratic effects of the Internet in the world, and we see the use of the Internet by extremist groups in a number of countries, but not just extremist groups, but this general phenomenon of fragmentation of communities through the Internet as at the same time that new communities are being formed. So it's a very confusing effect, but I think, again, it's one that we're just starting to understand. And more generally, you have what I would call the corrosive side of globalization. My colleague Moises Naim published a book last year called Illicit, which was about kind of the dark side of globalization. And he was talking about the fact that globalization has brought with it the spread of so many negative things, whether it's international drug trafficking, sort of international criminal enterprises of one type or another, and these really have very harmful effect on societies. We see this with the Mexican state. The Mexican state is struggling very hard against this illicit world and is being captured by parts of it, and this is doing damage to Mexican democracy. So when we ask what are the structural forces pushing against democracy in the contemporary world, we have oil prices, we have the fragmentation of communities, we have the negative side of globalization, as well, of course, as the rise of China and the general sense of the counterweight to Europe and the United States as global powers. On the positive side, there are positive structural forces as well, and that's what I think the survey gets at, is the first and foremost is there is this continuing spread of global norms about democracy. We can talk about why this is occurring, but I think this finding, which is really quite striking about the high level of acceptance of the idea of elections as the sole legitimate means of choosing a government, is a result over the last 20 to 30 years of this spread of global norms, and it's something that's powerful and unlikely to be reversed in the near term and likely to have consequences in a number of countries where elections are not currently practiced in that way. So there is a diffusion of norms, and I think those who work on democracy promotion have struggled in this decade between, on the one hand, recognizing there is a lot of bad news out there. A lot of dark things are going on. At the same time, how come when we work at the day-to-day level in many societies, we're finding so many counterparts, we see so much activity and enthusiasm, and they're caught between the low-level picture and this high-level picture? And I think that's reflected there. Secondly, the other large structural factor is that, leaving aside the issue of high commodity prices, economic development is continuing generally in the world. And yes, there is this general correlation over world history as that the wealthier societies become, on average, the more democratic they come. And so if the 21st century of economic development really continues, as it may well throughout this century, then this will probably have structural consequences as well. So it's a very mixed picture, both with respect to how much good news and bad news is there out there, and what is the balance of these causal forces. And what I find is that this survey ends up kind of exemplifying both some of that good news and that bad news in the following ways. When I look at some of the findings, the first, the will of the people, he didn't really emphasize it here, but when you look at the numbers and study them carefully, what's striking is that Turkey, Nigeria, Ukraine, and Indonesia have a much higher belief that the will of the people should be the basis of authority than many established democracies. And I thought about why that's the case, why those countries and why not. It may be that people who, faced with the question about should the will of the people be the basis of authority, those who are in sort of constitutional liberal traditions, as in many established Western democracies, tend to react to that question with agreeing but not strongly because they're a bit hesitant about rule by the majority or populist democracy. They tend to think the basis of authority may be a constitution, it may be the law, and so forth. And so I think what you're seeing is that answer mediated by other values that people have that say, yes, the will of the people should be the basis of authority, but people are actually less critical of that idea and embrace it even more in countries where they have less of a constitutional liberal tradition, and they tend to just say, yes, the will of the people, and not think about the possible consequences of that answer or alternatives to it. That's just a hypothesis on my part. The key question that I think is, what is this about trust in government, and why is it that China, India, Egypt, and Russia, those societies show high trust in government on this poll, and Great Britain, Argentina, Mexico, United States, Indonesia, Ukraine, South Korea, and so forth, show low trust? It's important to go back to the findings of the political scientist out in California, Russell Dalton, who's been doing surveys of trust in government since the mid-1970s, or actually before. And he's found that in established democracies, ever since, and he poses it, he calls it in a sense the Watergate dilemma, ever since mid-1974, trust in government in Western established democracies has been going steadily downward. It started in the United States in 1973-74 with Vietnam and Watergate, but then he says that fever caught hold in Western Europe, and in the second half of the 1970s, Sweden, Germany, Great Britain, France, and so forth joined the United States and began this sort of from the high 70s to kind of the low 30s in percentage of trust in government. It's just gone steadily downward. And so one question is why that's occurred, and I think that's a question worth considering separately. And I think we all kind of, or those who are sort of have an intuitive sense of the U.S. society, at least, or certain European societies, kind of understand it as being the result of a certain sort of loss of traditional attitude with respect to authority in the country and a sense of increased individualism and a question of the establishment and changing social norms and other things, rather than kind of specific practices about democracy. Then I think it's a separate question of why do citizens in Egypt, Russia, China, and probably similar countries have such high trust in government. And there, you know, and there we're really speculating a bit, but I would first of all be very wary about the fact that these are societies in which the population is manipulated by governmental media that works very, very hard every single day on the television to present positive images of the government. And these are, you know, very serious enterprises by controlling political authorities that must have consequences over time and the people. Because you could say, well, maybe the Chinese and the Russian government, they've performed so well economically in this decade, people trust them because they're delivering. Well, what about Egypt then? I mean, if you want a government that's not really delivering, Egypt has experienced economic growth in the last 2 or 3 years, but if you look at a government that really over the last 20 years has not done very well for the majority of its people, the Egyptian government would certainly be in that. So why Egyptians have such a high trust in government, I think you do have to go back to explanations of propaganda, repression, paternalism, and so forth, and say that there are other reasons why this is showing up. But I think it's important to separate out and ask why are established democracies decreasing in the level of trust, and why do a number of authoritarian societies have relatively high trust? So I would conclude just by saying that I find, just as there's good news and bad news out there, I find actually quite good news the widespread support for the will of the people and for elections, and that there's no apparent temptation of another method or system, I do find troubling the fact that trust in government inversely correlates to the state of democracy. But actually, that doesn't, I don't think, fundamentally worry me, because I don't think Swedish democracy is fundamentally in trouble, yet it has a fairly low level of trust in the government. And one can argue that a certain kind of, you know, democratic aspiration is for people to have a relatively low trust in government, to be skeptical of authority, and that's not in and of itself a sign that democracy is failing. So I think there are mixed results here, but I think there are some things worth exploring. But if we put it into the framework of the overall state of democracy in the world, I think we need to take this as, in a sense, like the condition of the state of democracy, is mixed evidence that can contribute both to some optimism and some pessimism, but above all, the need to look more closely at what's really going on in a number of societies. Tom?
Hey. If I may, I take the prerogative here on the question of why trust in government is high in Egypt and Jordan. I did focus groups in both of those countries, and what came through, it was kind of interesting, was that our government doesn't really run the country. The United States really runs the country, was the thing that came through. And our government, well, they're doing their best to kind of look out for us as they deal with this overpowering force of the United States. And so they expressed some confidence in their government, even though they had criticisms of particular things they were doing, but when, to the extent that those are there, they tended to be blamed on the United States. So they're kind of unique, Egypt and Jordan, in that regard. Tom Milia is the Deputy Executive Director of Freedom House. Before that, he was director of research at the Institute for the Study of Diplomacy at Georgetown University. And before that, for more than 12 years, he was at the National Democratic Institute for International Affairs, where he worked on democracy promotion programs worldwide.
Thank you, Steve. Thank you all for coming. This is quite a turnout, which I think reflects the interest in the subject and the work you've done. And I want to congratulate you especially on doing this research in the 60th anniversary year of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, and for the way you've taken some key passages from that declaration and tried to test their resonance with the world's peoples. I think this is a very important thing to do. I'm glad you've done it, and it's interesting to see what is coming out of it in the series of reports that your center is producing. The invitation for this event put this in the context. I think you said in it the poll sheds valuable and sometimes surprising light on the core issues of how widely democracy is valued in the world, a crucial question in an international context in which many argue that democracy is losing ground. And I just want to echo a little bit what Tom said a moment ago, that there are essentially two reasons for that. One is that there are governments who are intervening to keep their people from having democracy, and you had a number of those governments surveyed in your survey. And as Tom mentioned, there is this actual campaign underway in the world for governments to campaign against democracy as we know it, and as we believe it usually exists. But the other reason that democracy is losing ground is because of actual failures of nascent democracies to deliver useful things to their people. And these arise from diverse kinds of reasons, due especially in most places to endemic corruption that is really weighing down the ability of these new democracies to operate in any kind of productive way with public resources and in being responsive to ordinary people. So the corruption is really a huge factor, I think, in the failure of many new democracies to deliver. But it's also accompanied by more ordinary incompetence of new governing officials who don't yet know how to do their jobs in many of these countries. And then many of them are beset by strife and violence of different kinds, whether domestic or cross-border kinds of challenges. And so I think there's a lot of things that these new democracies are struggling with that makes it hard for them to deliver democracy, even when they're well-intentioned. So that's part of the reason for the frustration and lack of trust or confidence in governments in some of the emerging democracies that we saw on those tables. And then, of course, but that's accompanied by this very separate, very different kind of challenge to democracy, which is coming from the non-democratic governments in the world, who are capturing some of the language and turning it to explain repression and autocracy in the name sometimes of democracy, whether sovereign democracy or Islamic democracy or managed democracy or whatever the adjective is in a various place. So I think we need to look more at the context in which these numbers arise. And I want to just refer to a couple of things that arise from your numbers. Tom mentioned briefly, but I wanted to explore it a little bit more, this question of how seriously to take the numbers in some of these countries. As a reformed pollster myself, I spent a year or two learning the trade and doing some opinion research. I find that one of the most interesting things to look at in any of these kinds of reports are the footnotes. And so I would ask you, when you're looking at this 11-page version, the frequency questionnaire that goes through the basic questions and answers for all of the countries surveyed, look at the very last page and the 11 footnotes. They were touched upon a bit in one of the early questions that Steve responded to, but this is really kind of interesting because it tells you the different ways in which the surveys were conducted. And then there's a couple things that aren't really mentioned explicitly on this methodology page, but I think are worth noting. They're sort of hidden in the presentation. To the extent that I know of the local partners that you worked with in some of these countries, they're among the most reputable, well-known surveying organizations in these countries. So there's no reason to question their motives or their competence. They look like very good local partners to have worked with. But on the other hand, you said that in assessing the integrity of the numbers, you mentioned that in no place that you know of was any respondent ever punished for responding to a question. But I don't think it's ever the case that respondents to surveys would be punished for answering a question and saying they were critical of the government. Who gets punished is the surveyor. It's the organization that goes out and asks the questions. And that's where you get into, in some cases, some kinds of self-censorship, where some surveying partners are hesitant or reluctant to ask questions. And you did note that in some countries, some questions weren't asked. And I don't know, maybe you could explain later the extent to which this kind of self-censorship by your partners played a role in that. I noticed that it was Egypt and Iran and Jordan where some questions dropped out of your tables you don't have responses to. And those are, especially Egypt and Iran, I know are places where pollsters have gotten in trouble with the authorities in the past for asking questions that the authorities didn't want asked, let alone answered. I say that because I think that you may have underappreciated the significance of the repressive atmosphere and the way it may have influenced some of the findings that suggest that some of these governments are more highly regarded by their peoples than we would expect at first glance. As you note in your report, the five publics that have the greatest amount of trust for their government are Egypt, China, Russia, Palestinian territories, and Jordan. And that just, you know, that there's something that just sort of resonates wrongly about that. I don't doubt that they told your interviewers that, but I can't believe that 84% of the people in Egypt have a high degree of confidence that they can trust their government most of the time. It just, something doesn't ring right about that. I think we have to explore why people would answer the way they did a question that was put to them and, explore that a little more. One of the other sort of correlations that you noted is that trust in government is negatively related to education. Well, that's why government's so highly regarded here in Washington with all these overeducated people know too much about what goes on in government. But Tom mentioned the work of Russ Dalton out in California. Abby, if you're still around, where's Abby? I brought along a table that was presented by Russ Dalton some years ago. This actually appeared in the Economist about 10 years ago. I'm sure you've seen it. It talks about this long-term decline in trust and confidence in politicians and government in democracies. And it's important to put this in context. Your survey, I think, underscores the depths to which some of the established democracies have sunk. But the broader point that's conveyed in these, and I'm sorry I didn't bring enough of them, you had, again, a bigger audience than I expected, underscores that this decline in trust in political leaders and in government more generally, and particularly in elected politicians, seems to be declining almost everywhere over time, over the last 30 and 40 years. Clearly, you know, Dalton and others have talked about the Watergate effect, but it's important to think about what that really is. It's not so much that we found out that our governments will fib to us sometimes, but also it marked a sort of resurgence of our media and the scrutineers, the NGOs, the watchdogs, and so on. And so we learn most of what we know about our government in this country comes not from the government through orchestrated television of the kind that Tom mentioned happens in Azerbaijan and Egypt and so on as part of a public campaign. But most of what we learn about our government comes from critics of our government, from journalists who've exposed something, from a watchdog organization that's unhappy with something. And it's important to know that, you know, where we get our information is going to shape our attitudes. And so it, again, maybe a perversely positive indicator of the degree of our democracy that, you know, we have that kind of access to critical information and to scandal and to the seedier side of what government does and what politicians do with their prominence and prestige. So it's what this means is there are two kinds of reasons for why people have a lack of trust in their government. In some cases, it's because they don't have enough information or enough freedom or enough usefulness coming out of their government that will make them unhappy. In other cases, it's because they've got too much information about what their government's doing. And I don't know that we've plumbed that enough yet in this survey. I think there's a lot of interesting questions that arise from this that one would like to ask in the next time you go back to Egypt or the next time you go back to Iran, especially. I'd like to know many more things. So hopefully this kind of work will lay a foundation for greater examination of, you know, the follow-up questions. You know, why? What do people think they're answering when they answer this question? What do people really mean by their answers? Which I would like to hear more about. Two other questions about the way questions are put. You know, we began with this quotation from the Universal Declaration of Human Rights that the will of the people, the basis of government should be the will of the people. And what we're reminded of, I think, in some of this data is that the question is really the will of which people? In this country, where the public, the voting public at least, is famously divided about 50-50 between the political parties, and we'll see that again probably in November, when you have a 51-49% election environment, it means that at least 49% of the people are going to be unhappy with the result. And so they're going to think that the government is not being responsive to them, their particular agenda. And then there's going to be some of the people who voted for the guy that are going to be unhappy as well. So, again, it's I think in a free society in which people will naturally disagree, it is necessarily the case that some people will be unhappy with whoever gets elected or whatever policy is adopted. And so that has to be factored in here somehow, that people will agree in theory that the government should be responsive to the will of the people, but not those people, my people. And I think that's another dimension that we need to explore further about whose people the government is being responsive to. I found your question about opinion polls interesting, about whether people should government should look at opinion surveys in making policy or care about opinion in other countries when making policy. And it's a reminder of the, I guess it turns out that I'm not a complete Democrat. I think there are values. There is value to constraints on majoritarian instincts, and that you know, we would not want our government, I presume, to be governed by opinion polls because it puts too much power in the hands of you, the pollster. You get to frame the question and get people to answer it, and then you will have
broke the code.
You get to ask the question. You can not only, I mean, you may ask the wrong question, or, you know, it may not be the way, because as we've famously been reminded in some of the political discussion, most Americans, for instance, are not highly polarized in their own personalities. They want a little bit of this and a little bit of that. Our politics drive people, and our polling questionnaires drive people to choose black or white. And most people are gray. And so I think that when you frame a question in a poll, just as in California they famously frame lots of policy questions in referenda, you can get a misbegotten result somehow because you haven't asked the right policy question or you haven't asked the right opinion survey question. Not that it's a right or wrong answer, but just that whatever you've asked fails to get to some other aspects of it that can only be reconciled in a deliberative political process in a legislature or in a government where the people have to defer some judgment to elected and appointed officials to work out all the necessary details. So I come out somewhere between the Burkean complete delegation to elected officials and the world public opinion isms that want everything to be decided by plebiscite. I think that we need to get the best of both and when we shape our policies. One last observation. You put up an interesting array of countries based on the ranking of democracy as promulgated by something called the Economist Intelligence Unit. Mm-hmm. Now, you did invite somebody from Freedom House here. and we actually have a more rounded way of describing the rank order of political freedom and democratic institutional development in societies around the world that would not have, for instance, the Palestinian Authority ranked more democratic than Turkey, for instance. I think with an over-focus on electoral issues alone, as their index does, you end up with some odd alignments, I think, in those groups. But that's a small detail. We can work that out before the next year's presentation when we can give you a better kind of matrix for presenting your data. But thanks for the invitation, and I look forward to more discussion.
Just a few quick comments. On the question of censorship, there were a few questions that were not allowed in Iran and a few in Egypt. I don't think we had any limits in China, and I think that covers it. Keep in mind that these three countries, it's something of a miracle that we're polling in them at all.
And you mentioned the local polling partners in your
right, appendix. Right. Well, we do in Egypt. Just a few quick comments on the Freedom House question. We did use Freedom House measures on our Freedom of the Press study. Since the EUI one was more specifically focused on democracy, and so we went with that one in this case, and didn't find that there were big differences. On the question of the will of the people, my people versus your people, in the U.S. we once asked the question, would you prefer to have outcomes that are mostly what the majority of Democrats would favor, what the majority of Republicans would favor, or what the majority of the entire public would favor. And if, in fact, you're a Democrat and you would theoretically want Democratic wishes to prevail, not the whole public where the Democrats would be diluted, but in fact, large majorities of both Democrats and Republicans favored outcomes that were the will of the whole people, not just people like them. Also, the question of outcomes. Are people misperceiving when they believe that the will of the people is not, in fact, what's happening? There have been some studies that have been done on this. They all pose some problems. But in the United States, it appears that over the decades, this effort has been going on for some decades, there's actually been a decline in correlation between public opinion and government decisions. While a few decades ago it was about two-thirds of the time government decisions were consistent with majority opinion, that has declined so that in the most recent one, it was barely above 50%. And given that they're going to be in line with the public half the time just by chance, it appears that there's really there's little correlation.